The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Gastroesophageal reflux disease diagnostic testing is presented by Dr. Stephen Hoffman.
These are our objectives. I'm going to spend most of the time on the first two bullet points. And I think the last two are kind of interesting, and so we'll cover those with the last two slides. One of the reasons I think GERD is such an interesting topic is because it's so common. It's estimated that 20% of adult Americans have symptoms that are attributable to GERD, and it's very likely that that's going to increase because obesity is associated with GERD, and we all know what's happening with obesity. I love Yogi Berra. There's just a wisdom to Yogi, and there's going to be a lot of forks in the road with our management of GERD. It is deceptively simple, and we have a lot of decisions to make. Well, these are the typical symptoms. And I think what's interesting about these typical symptoms, and non-cardiac chest pain means that the cardiologists have told us it's not cardiac, is that they're not very specific. Actually, the best studies suggest there's only 60% specific, and yet these are the typical symptoms. That tells us that we're going to have some problems. But these are less typical symptoms, and there may be reasons to treat patients who present with these symptoms. We'll discuss that as we go along, but obviously they're less specific than the typical symptoms. So that's going to result in some rather interesting decisions. Okay, so the first fork in the road is, do we test them or do we treat them? And in this day and age, the only test that's really considered appropriate is EGD. Well, if they have alarm symptoms, we need to test them. And if they don't, we need to treat them. That's pretty straightforward. The alarm symptoms are not so straightforward. And I'd like to draw your attention to the second and fourth bullet point. Maybe we should just call them points. If you noticed in the fine print of the first slide, there was a reference to the American College of Gastroenterology's guidelines for GERD. And that's an outstanding reference on GERD. And a lot of the evidence base that is behind the slides today comes from the ACG's guidelines. They're really interesting to read. They're well written. And what the ACG does is grades the level of evidence and then gives you their recommendations, and then in the next few paragraphs explains where that evidence base comes from and why. And so if you really have an interest in GERD that I don't answer, guidelines will pretty much answer almost everything you want to know. So they've made a change. And in the second point, they've moved the age of an alarm symptom from 50 to 60, which I think is really interesting. And they give their reasons for it. And they're even considering moving it to 65. And progressive dysphagia replaces dysphagia. So that if a patient's been having dysphagia for 10 years, it's absolutely stable, they don't consider that an alarm symptom. Risk factors, multiple risk factors for Barrett's include being a white man, abdominal obesity, family history of Barrett's or NOCA, long-standing reflux symptoms, and that's 5 years or greater. Well, everybody recommends that we start our treatment for GERD, and now we're going to follow the patient who has no alarm symptoms with these lifestyle modifications. I've got a real problem with this. The first is, we're not really interested in weight loss, we're interested in sustained weight loss. Now, there's no question that patients that have abdominal obesity have increased incidence of GERD. And we know that when our patients get pregnant, that they're more likely to get GERD symptoms. That's multifactorial, but in part due to the increased abdominal weight, which increases your intragastric pressure and can cause reflux. And that if they lose weight, the GERD gets better. The problem is, can they keep it off? And if we're going to ask our patients to lose weight, that's not a two-minute discussion. That is real hard. The NIH has gone over with maybe 30 different studies in their website of sustained weight loss, and in an intensive therapy, it's about 30%. So I don't know, we have to think about what we're doing. Now, when I was a fellow, my fellows hate when I start that. Anything like that. We didn't have potent acid suppression. And elevation of the head of the bed was extremely effective for nocturnal reflux. There's only one little problem with it. Patients hated it. I mean, hated it. They're slipping off the end of the bed. We had to put bedboards down there. If you use a wedge, it's got to be down to the waist. Can't just be for the head and neck. That doesn't work. And even though they were having problems with nocturnal reflux, most of them just wouldn't do it. Now that we have more potent acid suppressions, I think it's very unlikely you're going to get patients that are willing to do this. I do think the last point is valid, and some people suggest that you avoid a fatty meal as well with that last meal because it delays gastric emptying. Okay, so what's our medical therapy? It's step up or step down. Step up means that you start with minimal amount of acid reduction and then increase it until you get a good clinical response. So you might start with H2RAs and antacids. You might go H2RA once a day and then twice a day and acids. And if they don't respond to all of that, give them a PPI. Step down is to start with a PPI once daily. And then, if you get a good clinical response, reduce your acid suppression. Step down works faster, patients like it better, physicians like it better, and it's more cost effective. So the question that you're asking me is, well, if that's true, why do we even bother with step up? Well, I don't know if your patients are like mine. They get their medical advice from the internet and from their aunt and from all different types of sources. I try to tell them the great quote from Abraham Lincoln, "Don't trust everything you read on the internet." It doesn't seem to work that well. So there are patients who are very reluctant to take PPIs. Well, for short term, they're pretty safe. In fact, they're very safe. The side effect profile, which is, these are the three most prominent, are seen in 1 to 5%. But what's fascinating is it's also seen in 1 to 5% of placebo. So I don't even know if these are really true side effects. Of course, if you have a patient that starts a PPI and gets a headache or whatever, they're sure it's due to the PPI. You can change your PPI once. After that, it's not going to work. The last point is a true risk, and it's a really interesting one in that it's very short term, usually within the first 2 weeks after starting a PPI, and predominantly young men. And we're not 100% sure why that occurs. It's rare, it's 3 per 2,000, which is not very much, and treatable, but that is a true risk. Okay, so we've started our patients on either step up or step down. What's going to happen? I mean, where are we going to go? We're going to get one of these three responses, right? Either they're going to get better, completely better, they're going to be partly better, or they're not going to get better at all. Okay, The easiest one now is for resolution of symptoms, we're going to decrease our acid suppression to the lowest possible dose. So that after, the month or two of therapy, we're going to start reducing their PPIs and their H2RAs. Now what's going to happen, their PPIs. What's going to happen after we do this? Well, this is the next forks in the road. We're either going to be able to get them off, maybe not. We start to get them off and they get their symptoms back, or we're not going to get them off at all. ACOI asked me to give you some pearls. I've got a couple for perhaps earrings, but not enough for a necklace. This pearl is that when you stop PPIs 5 to 7 days after you stop them, you're going to get an increased acid secretion. So if you stop PPIs and a week later the patient gets recurrence of their symptoms, it's because they've got hyperacidity at that time. And so when we want to wean them off, we want to wean them off after we stop PPIs with an H2RA, maybe once or twice daily for a couple weeks. And this will give you more patients that you're able to wean off. The last possibility is that we're just unable to wean the patient off. Why is this a problem? Why don't we just leave them on PPIs forever? Because the risk of long-term use is different than short-term. And I gotta see which is your left. Gotta find my left from my right here. All right, well, the real but small risks. The renal insufficiency is recently being challenged as a true risk, but as of now, it's still considered a real risk. And again, a very small percentage of patients, maybe 1 in 100, but I think that it's reasonable to check their renal function periodically, maybe 3 to 12 months. Enteric infections are clearly a true risk, particularly C. difficile infections, but also maybe Salmonella and Shigella and some other pathogens. Magnesium deficiency only if they're on diuretics. If they're not on diuretics, that's not a risk. The other three, hepatic encephalopathy, spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, and the possibility of increased mortality, are associations that have not been disproven to be true risks. But under the other column, well, we see probably not risks. Now, I'm sure that most of the people in the audience have been aware of the controversies about PPIs and Plavix, easier for me to say, and osteoporosis and fractures on PPI therapy. And these have been investigated fairly rigorously, and they're not risks. They're just not risks. Most of these risks, in fact, all of these risks on this side, in this column, were found by association. And when they were subjected to more rigorous testing, they did not exist. And so we don't feel that these are true risks. The dementia is interesting because that came up maybe 4 or 5 months ago from a study in Germany, where they were able to associate long-term PPI use with dementia. And also they thought it was dose-related, and they tried to adjust for confounding factors. I just think that was too difficult to do. And then, interestingly, in the last 2 months, there's a study published on, which was much better controlled, on elderly patients being given PPIs in extended care facility, and found that it appeared to retard cognitive decline, not cause it. So we don't think that's a true risk. So most of these aren't true risks, but there are some. And the conclusion is something I think AT still would be very happy with. And that is, if you need it, use it, and if you don't, don't. And this is going to be important when we consider what we're going to do in evaluating our patients. And first problem here is that there's no clear answer what to do with that patient that's responded well, and you can't wean off. You know what those risks are, and they're small, okay? So it's not unreasonable just to continue on PPIs and that's it. I prefer an accurate diagnosis as to what's going on. And I think that there are a reasonable percentage of these patients that really don't need PPIs. But the testing is not that easy. At least it isn't for the patient. It's easy for me, but not for them. And so you have to understand what your patient is about as to whether you want to have them go through further testing, which we'll talk about, and why we would do it. Well, in the partial response group, the most important point is the first one. And it's amazing how often patients do not take PPIs appropriately. With the exception of Dexilant and Zegrid, they should be given half an hour before their first meal, and they should be given daily, not PRN or three or four times a week. Okay. Interestingly, there's some data that suggests that Zegrid works better at night. But they can be given at any time, so that's my second pearl. But you need to go over compliance. If they are compliant, then you really have a choice. You can change your PPI. I don't like that, but there's some data to suggest that some patients will respond to one PPI and don't respond to another. Why that would be true is hard to understand because the physiology is identical, really. Or you can go to more aggressive acid suppression. So aggressive acid suppression would be a BID PPI, H2RAHS. Another pearl, alginic acid has a unique property that may help turn this partial response to a complete response, in that it forms a foam that floats up to the top of the fundus and is a barrier then to reflux. There's a theory that some patients who haven't responded to GERD therapy have an acid pocket up in the fundus, and the GERD, this alginic acid or Gaviscon would be helpful in that regard, and particularly at HS. And there's a Japanese study that shows that there's some significant gain when you do that. So we can do those, or we can consider an EGD. Now, the more interesting position is when you have no response. This is the third fork in the road. So patients are not going to respond to a daily PPI at all. They're not going to respond to more acid suppression. So there's no sense in putting them into an aggressive program. You can either do an EGD, or you can assume that this is non-reflux disease and treat them for what we call functional esophageal disease. Functional esophageal disease is treated with neuromodulators, basically tricyclic antidepressants, SSRIs. And I think that it's very important if you're going to take that route to explain to the patient that this is not a psychoactive drug. It's being given in a significantly lower dose than the antidepressant dose. So TCAs, we give it about the maximum dose of 50 milligrams QHS, right? And that's 1/2 to 1/4 of the dose that was used to treat depression. And we don't use TCAs very much for depression anyways. So that I tell my patients, if you're depressed, this isn't going to help. You're going to still be depressed. What we're doing is we're tamping down a hyper-excitable nerve fibers from your esophagus. I use an example. If I pat you on the arm, it's not going to hurt. But if it's sunburned, it will. And so we're trying to do that. That's our rationale. Well, why would we do EGDs? What can we find out on EGDs other than making the gastroenterologist rich, which they don't anymore, by the way? Well, we can find non-erosive reflux, NERD, ERD, or an anatomical abnormality. The last point being unlikely, but occurs. I mean, occasionally you can get rarely you can get a tumor that has no alarm symptoms. That would be very unusual, but we've seen strictures, and we biopsy patients for eosinophilic esophagitis and get some positive biopsies, and that changes therapy completely. But it's either going to look normal or it's not, okay? So if it's erosive reflux disease and the patient's on PPIs, we've got to review compliance again. And if they are maximum medical therapy and they're refluxing, we need manometry and pH impedance, okay? Because if they are refluxing in spite of maximum medical therapy, they're going to strongly consider surgical therapy, endoscopic or surgical therapy for reflux. And manometry is extremely important because there's often hidden motility disorders that would either change the reflux procedure or in fact even stop it. And high-resolution manometry is a fascinating tool. It takes about 10 minutes. And we have found a significant number of motility disorders. So for NERD, this is where they have to go. And again, this is what we're going to find. Now, you don't always need to get mucosal damage with reflux. So we can see occasional patients who are refluxing without mucosal damage. Dr. Don Castell from the University of South Carolina is the leading manometrist probably in the country, and he feels that up to 30% of refluxers are refluxing non-acid. Okay, they're warning me. But good for them, I'm almost done. Okay. Originally, ACOI asked me to lecture on GERD and H. pylori, and I said, well, that's a two-minute lecture. I don't think I can drag that out for half an hour. But I think their concerns are interesting in that the European guidelines differ from the American guidelines on GERD and H. pylori. First of all, the treatment of H. pylori has nothing to do with the treatment of GERD. If they're H. pylori positive and GERD and you leave them there, or if they're H. pylori positive and you eradicate the H. pylori, you don't change what happens to the GERD. GERD remains the same. The difference is patients who require long-term acid suppression will accelerate the growth of GERD, and it will come proximal into the stomach up to the fundus and can involve the entire stomach, resulting in atrophic gastritis, and atrophic gastritis is a precursor for gastric cancer. So the Europeans, in order to avoid gastric cancer, recommend testing and eradicating GERD. The difference is that the base incidence of gastric cancer is significantly higher in Europe than in the United States. And so the number to treat in the United States is significantly greater to avoid lung gastric cancer. It's not felt to be in the patient's best interest in the United States to do this. I certainly think that if the patient had a family history of gastric cancer, though, that I would test and treat. And the last is where gastroenterologists argue with everybody, okay? Now, I polled my ENT colleagues and my pulmonary colleagues, and they're absolutely convinced that for the first 4 points, PPI therapy can be significant. ENT tells me, 80% of our patients with laryngitis and chronic cough get better on PPIs, okay? And pulmonary thinks that for COPD and for asthma, particularly adults with difficult to control asthma, PPIs can make the big difference. And possibly even in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis with microaspiration. There's only one problem with this, is that we have studied this, and you can see the references in the ACG guideline, and in well-designed, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials, they do nothing. PPIs do nothing. They are no better than the placebo arm, over and over again. So the question is, do you believe your eyes or do you believe your studies? Okay. If you want to compromise, I would say, look, if the PPIs work or appear to work, I don't care. Go ahead. You can give them the PPIs. for a couple months. But if you want to keep them on it forever, you should get manometry and pH impedance to document that this is truly related to reflux. Thank you very much for your kind attention.